Hello and welcome to this podcast from Yale University Press, London. You can find out more about books published by Yale by going to www.yalebooks.co.uk. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is David Crystal, one of the world's leading experts on language and all its manifestations. Now an honorary professor of linguistics at Bangor, David has enjoyed an astonishingly productive writing career. His output of over 100 books includes dictionaries and encyclopedias of language, specialist academic works in phonetics, and books for schools, miscellanies, and an autobiography. The book he's publishing in March 2010 is entitled simply A Little Book of Language, but it contains a treasure trove of information about the wonders and mysteries of language, aimed at younger readers in their pre and early teens. That said, there's a great deal in the book to fascinate readers of all ages, on how we acquire language, how languages change, develop, and sometimes die, on what changes technology is bringing to language today, and what will shape the language of the future. When we met, I began by asking David if he was already interested in language when he was the age of the readers his book is intended for.
I certainly was, and the reason is quite clear, because I was brought up in a bilingual area in North Wales, where there was Welsh and there was English, and there was English spoken at home. My family did not speak Welsh at home, but on the street it was there. And I remember at a very early age, in my third or fourth year, being puzzled about why I could understand you, but I can't understand you. What's going on here? You know, this was a real puzzle to me. Slowly it got worked out because kids would tell me, and kids who spoke Welsh would teach me bits of Welsh, and you learned that there were many different ways of communicating. When you went to school, of course, you learned the language as a second language in the classroom. And then gradually, as you went through school, especially secondary school, other languages came along. You know, I learned French and Greek and Latin and so on. And then you became aware of the importance of multilingualism as a phenomenon. So I think that's the idiosyncrasy of my own background. These days, I think everybody is aware of multilingualism as a phenomenon, partly because of the media and the fact that you see these things on television so much and on the radio and on the internet, of course, especially these days, but also because the existence of immigration in all countries has suddenly upped the ante as far as levels of multilingualism are concerned. I mean, there are 400 languages spoken in London, let alone the numbers in other cities. And so you can't avoid the existence of multilingualism. And therefore, one of the reasons for writing a book of this kind is perhaps to give kids an informed background about why multilingualism exists, how to cope with it, how to deal with it, how to interact with it, how to make themselves a little multilingual, even if the curriculum doesn't allow you to do so because they're not teaching languages as much as they should at secondary level. Nonetheless, you can go out and do your own language learning.
Maybe it seemed self-evident the place to begin was children's language acquisition, but I thought it was a wonderfully fresh way of engaging people's interest, because when you actually think about it, it's a miracle, really. It's an amazing process that you describe, how a child goes from having no language when it's born to within a year or so being able to communicate at some level.
It is one of the most fascinating aspects of the whole language business. But the reason why I chose it for the opening chapters of the book was not because of its intrinsic interest, but because I think it's very important when you're talking to young people, young teenagers, older junior school people, that sort of thing, that you give them a subject that they feel superior to, that they feel that they can look down upon. A lot of the subjects, like, say, foreign language learning, they feel inferior because they haven't had much chance to learn foreign languages yet. And indeed, most of the topics in the book, they won't yet have had a chance to come to grips with. But they all know about younger kids. They all know that babies, they maybe have baby brothers and sisters, for example, and things of that kind. Certainly they know that when they were in primary school, they are now not, they are in secondary school, and so they can look back at language acquisition from a position of superiority. And I think that gives you a kind of confidence in approaching the subject matter, which if I'd started in some other area, it might not have had.
And I like the little asides you made about recording your own son's language acquisition. You clearly, we're not above you using your family as material for the study of linguistics.
Oh, absolutely. They're all guinea pigs. I mean, anybody who comes into my ambit, you know, runs the risk of anything they say might be taken down and used in evidence against them at some point or another. And indeed, yes, I spent a lot of time recording and noting down what my kids were saying. They provide the best examples because, you know, you know the whole context. If you take an example out of a book, you're not entirely sure what the context is sometimes. So yes, it provides a human element. It also provides a model, because if I can do it, they can do it. You know, anybody can do this. Anybody can go around with a little notebook and jot down what other people are saying, and that's part of the point of the book, to show by doing how you do this sort of thing.
So one of the areas that you're particularly interested in is slang, and that's an area where young readers have ready access or are in the process of creating language change.
And moreover, creating slang and their own local dialect in a way that somebody like me could never know. It's very difficult getting hold of teenage slang. For a start, it's evanescent. It doesn't last for long always. It changes year by year. Boys and girls have different types and all the rest of it. Now, how do I get hold of that? You know, me as a linguist, I can't for the most part. I can you know, use examples that I've picked up over the years, but every school has got its own slang, every generation has, and these kids have got access to this in a way that no outsider has. So if they're interested in language and they want to study language in some way, one of the problems I find is that a lot of kids say, but it's all known, it's all been done, you know, we're not learning anything new here, we're just learning what somebody else has found out. Well, not in this area, because if they study their own locality, they know it better than anybody else does. And it only takes 5 or 10 minutes of meandering research to suddenly start collecting stuff that's never been collected before. And you get a sense of exploration, a sense of discovery, a sense of empowerment almost, that you are beginning to own the language that you'd taken for granted. And so I think a topic like slang is a very good one to put in, because kids can identify with it very quickly.
So maybe one byproduct of publishing the book will be you'll be recruiting a new generation of potential linguists.
Well, I hope so. I think everybody is a linguist to an extent, you know, in the sense that everybody is interested in language, fascinated by it some of the time. I've never met anybody who isn't interested in where does that word come from? Why do we call this place name what it is? You know, I'm naming my baby. You know, what does it mean, the baby's name? You know, these queries about language are always there at the back of your mind. So I think everybody is a potential linguist, therefore. But there's a bigger point than this. We are at a stage where, for all sorts of reasons, the increasing multi-ethnic nature of society, the speed of language change and so on, people panic about it. They don't know what's happening. They think languages are going down the drain because of all the changes that are taking place. They get there is a linguistic racism, that people will abuse people using language, but sometimes without realizing it, as in the famous Packy example of some months ago, where somebody, you know, member of the royal family, uses the word and didn't intend anything offensive, but suddenly realized it was a can of worms here, because you can't go around using that word. And so there is a sense in which the more you know about language, the more responsible a member of society you will become. So it isn't just a matter of becoming better linguists, it's becoming better citizens, better human beings, by seeing the power, the limitations, the dangers of language and getting a sense of how to manage it personally.
Now, what's your take on new technology? Is it changing language in ways that we have not previously seen before, or is it merely doing so at an accelerated pace?
Nothing in the new technology that I've seen is novel in any, you know, really new sense of the word. Every new technology brings new varieties of language, new phenomena, new changes in vocabulary and grammar, in orthography, punctuation, spelling, and so on. When printing came along, you got the newspapers and all of this. When the telephone came along, you get new styles of interaction. When the BBC came along, broadcasting generally, you got things like sports commentary that you never had before. You know, now the internet comes along and we're getting a whole new range of styles, from the web, through chat rooms, through social networking sites like Facebook, to text messaging, tweeting, the lot. And each one is introducing a new opportunity for self-expression, really. And the technology is shaping the expression. If you've got 160 characters, then you've got to text in using that limitation. If you've got 140 characters in Twitter, then you've got to text, send messages using that limitation. What's interesting is that people are developing new styles to suit the limitations or the opportunities of the technology without actually radically changing the language in any fundamental way. I mean, what new grammatical constructions have come into English as a result of the internet? You know, there's nothing really. A few new words, certainly, a few new punctuation marks and things like that, but, you know, no big deal. But certainly introducing changes at a greater rate than ever before. Because imagine it, once upon a time, if you and I wanted to introduce a new word into the English language. So we cook one up now and think, I want you, the rest of the world, to use this word. I mean, how on earth would we get that to happen? It would be very, very difficult. And it usually took a generation or so for a word to move around. Today, we've only got to put it onto Facebook. And if people like it, it'll be a million uses by tomorrow. And a lot of people will start using it in other circumstances, and it could get into the language by next week, as it were. So we've never encountered anything like that before. And it is the speed of change which one has to anticipate and again, manage. You know, you have to be aware that this is happening so that you can cope with it.
And I suppose words can come into being, but also become extinct very quickly. So the whole life cycle can be speeded up.
I imagine that's true, but it's always difficult to identify the death of a word. The birth of a word is easy, but when did a word die out? Has it ever died out, really? I mean, one looks at Shakespeare and one says, look at all the words in Shakespeare that we don't use today. But hang on a minute, we do use them today when we go and see a Shakespeare play. They're on stage and we're listening to them and understanding them to a greater or lesser extent. And afterwards, you and I can start playing silly language games and say, oh, forsooth, verily you did that. And suddenly we're using Shakespeare's language. So is it dead, you know? So there are certainly norms of usage and frequencies of usage of words and things like that. But one doesn't really know. I mean, in a sense, you could say that the internet is doing a better job of keeping words alive, because nothing ever goes from the internet. I mean, even if people stop using a word that was used in, shall we say, up to the year 2000, it's still on the internet. You know, nothing ever gets lost from the internet. It's still there. And if you type it into Google, you'll still find it, even if it's 10 years old. So in a sense, the internet is making language immortal.
Now, I suppose it's making some languages immortal, but another main theme of the book is that languages do die. And I get the impression you would like readers to be as aware of that and the potential loss as they are aware of species of animals, for example.
I think it's a very, very important point. At the end of the book, I give the kids six general guidelines to shape their linguistic world, the world that they will be living in 20, 30, 50 years' time. And what the very first point is, be aware of the importance of languages, the fact that there are so many endangered languages, the fact that there are so many dying languages. I mean, we're talking about half the languages of the world here, some 3,000 languages at risk of extinction in the course of the present century. And people should reflect on what the loss is. There's nothing here nothing in the book which says, you know, they must all be saved, because you have to be realistic about this. But you have to be as alert as possible to the need to document these. It's part of our heritage to be aware of what we've lost, because each language is a vision of the world, and every time a language goes, we've lost that vision. And especially if the language has never been written down, you know, we've lost it forever without ever knowing what it was like to be a human being in that linguistic mindset. And the way in which you can document and to some extent revitalize languages, because you can save some of them, is not difficult if three factors are present. If the people themselves must want their language saved, if the government must want the language saved, and if there's some money to help save it. Now, you know, who provides the money? The national organizations, the governments, and so on. Well, who persuades the government that this is an important issue? The voters. And who are the voters? These kids in 10, 15, 20 years' time. And so I think by alerting them to the issues here, one might actually be providing a foundation through which some of these otherwise seriously endangered languages might be able to survive.
Is there a distinction to be made between revitalizing a language, as you've just described it, and putting a language on a life support system? Because I sometimes wonder if a language has reached a point where all you can do is sort of keep it, in inverted commas, artificially alive.
Oh, if that were the case, then it would be pointless. One should never want to do that. Remember, the first criterion is, do the people themselves want to keep it alive? That is, the speakers of that language, not you and me. I mean, I'm, as a linguist, you know, what it's nothing to do with me in a sense. I mean, I'm fascinated, obviously, but it's not up to me to say that language must be kept alive. No, no, it's the people. And if you've got a community who are desperate to keep their language alive, then you've got a situation which where revitalization is, you know, a hopeful opportunity. Now, most, not all, endangered languages have communities that want to keep their language alive. I mean, some are quite happy for it to go, but they're a very small minority. Most endangered communities are very sad at the prospect of their language disappearing. And to anybody listening to this, I have to say to them simply, how would you feel if your language was on the brink of extinction? What would you have lost? What will the human race lose because your language is now about to disappear? Or put it another way, if your language had never been, what would you have lost? So I'm speaking English now. If English had never been, what would we have lost? Yeah, Shakespeare, Dickens, Chaucer, and so on. And every language has got its literary pieces of excellence that it would be savage to not have exist. And even these small languages around the world, spoken by only a few hundred people, also have their literary pieces of excellence, which it would be sad not to have existed. And the fact that, you know, in the next century, there's going to be some wonderful stuff coming out in English or French or German or Chinese, and therefore also some wonderful stuff coming out in some of these endangered languages, is a point that people should reflect. Now, you know, one has to be realistic. You can't save all species and you can't save all languages, but reflect on the difference. People say that of all the species in the world, something like 2 or 3% of them are at the moment at risk of extinction. 50% of the languages of the world are at risk of extinction. So there's a much greater crisis happening in language than there is in biology generally.
Towards the end of the book, you look to the future and speculate on some of the changes that the readers of this book will see in the course of their lifetimes and indeed in the next 10 years. And one of the areas you pick out is communication with machines, machines talking to us and us talking to machines.
This is a subject that it's so difficult to predict the future of because the technology is evolving so rapidly. I mean, we're recording this in the middle of a month, February, beginning of a month, where there's been an announcement about from Google about having a phone which will automatically translate between you and me. If you were speaking French to me and I was speaking English to you, then we'd understand each other by, we'd go through a piece of software and we'd hear each other in the other language, a sort of Babelfish of A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Oh, this is a couple of years off and there is some skepticism about how what sort of quality it's going to be. Myself, I'm very, very surprised if it's going to be efficient, but you never know. And this is the sort of thing that's happening. I mean, who would predict, who can possibly predict what's going to happen next as far as technology is concerned? Even you know, the whole internet thing is really only 20 years old. And who would have predicted 11 years ago, Google, you know, or mobile or text messaging? Twitter is only 2006, Facebook is 2004 or whatever it is. You know, that it's all so recent and each one of these new technologies is offering extraordinarily new perspectives for communication. So I think it is important that everybody and the kids in particular that are using this book will develop a sense of the movement of language, of how language evolves and particularly these days in relation to technology and to see what the problems are. And the problems are obvious that you get a piece of equipment like a voice-activated washing machine or answering phone or a sat-nav. Will it understand you? And the answer is sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So why not? And the answer is because sometimes it can't cope with your regional accent or it can't cope because you're speaking too fast. And you suddenly begin to realize the strengths and the weaknesses of talking to machines. We're a long way off the scenario of 2001 and Hal the computer talking to Dave about how things are. That's a long, long way. A lot of people think that, you know, that's around the corner, but it isn't. It is a long, long way away. But so getting a sense of how far we are along that road towards conversations with robots is, I think, an important aspect of this whole business.
David, I just wanted to ask you in conclusion, after all your years of studying language, can you say what it is that keeps your enthusiasm fresh? Because the enthusiasm for language comes off every page in this book. So what is it that each morning you get up and you still feel excited about language?
Because it's a new day. linguistically speaking, language doesn't stop still. The only languages that don't change are dead ones. And all the languages that we encounter every day are different tomorrow. Whatever English was today, it's going to be different tomorrow because something will have happened. Some new word will have come in, some new phrase will catch the imagination of the public, some new accent will emerge in some circumstance, you'll hear something on the radio that you've never heard before, and so on and so forth. It's the notion of language change. Like going down to the seaside and you see the waves rolling in and you think, tomorrow it'll be the same. But you go down and the beach is different tomorrow, and suddenly you see another piece of driftwood that's come in, or a different type of stone. And you think, even if you go down to the beach every day, you'll find something new every day. And it's a bit like that with language, I find. And so when I wake up in the morning, don't think of language all day long, but when I do, it's a wonder about what's going to happen next.
That was David Crystal. His little book of language is published in hardback in March 2010. You can find out more about the book by going to the Yale University Press website at www.yalebooks.co.uk. And there you'll also find details about all the books on the Yale list, current and forthcoming. Now it only remains for me to thank you for listening to this podcast from Yale University Press London, and say until next time, goodbye.